This is Anthony Stevens, March 14, 1984. New synthesis archetypes.
Thank you very much for that. It's always a great joy, a great pleasure to come to this country. One of the things I find so exciting about it is its dynamism, the way in which everything goes on changing and developing, particularly in the realm of ideas. The thing about Dear Old England, by contrast, is the way in which everything goes on steadfastly being the same. This is true not only of the villages, the inns, Stratford-on-Avon, Anne Hathaway's cottage, and the sandwiches which are sold there, but of the analytical psychologists as well. I sometimes think that if English Jungians ever succeed in discovering the philosopher's stone, it will be by petrifying Jung's ideas. One man who's written marvelously about England is a Hungarian called George Mikesh. He came to live there just before the outbreak of the Second World War. And he says that he discovered very quickly the importance that the English attribute to maintaining a stiff upper lip at times of catastrophe. But he was somewhat slower to learn the importance of backing up this stoical attitude with a fair measure of hypocrisy. He says that he finally was taught this lesson in 1944 when he was having a drink with an English friend in a London pub. I don't know if any of you were old enough to be GIs in those days, but in 1944 it was the time of the buzz bombs, you know, the V1s that came flying like sort of demented motorcyclists over the roof towards you. And when they came overhead, you pretended that nothing was happening. You kept on chatting away, you know, to your friends as if nothing was happening. But you were praying secretly that it wouldn't cut out, because if it did, it just fell on you. You were praying that it would go on and fall on somebody else. Not a very Christian attitude, but understandable in the circumstances. Anyway, here he was sitting in this pub talking to this English friend, and sure enough, they heard the demented motorcyclist. They went on talking. When it was overhead, it cut out. And in that moment, Mikesh decided that whatever happened, his lip would remain resolutely stiff. He would remain on his stool at the bar, come what may. There was a shattering explosion as the bomb landed in the next street. The windows blew in. Bottles and glasses smashed, the air was thick with bricks and plaster, and Mikesh remained sitting on his stool. When the dust had settled, he turned towards his neighbour and, to his great delight, saw that he had measured his length on the floor. Mikesh rejoiced in a brief moment of triumph, but it was very short-lived. Quite unabashed, the Englishman got to his feet, brushed some of the dust from his jacket, and smiling sarcastically said, "Good heavens, were you too frightened to move?" Well, in Europe, Jungian psychology has got caught in the same trap. By sticking firmly to its position, it seems too frightened to move. Although you wouldn't think it, there have been a number of highly significant advances in the behavioral sciences since Jung died in 1961. But none of these has been due to analytical psychologists. Indeed, none of them has been due to psychologists at all. They've been due to the biologists who study the behavior of animals living in their natural habitats, the science, the upstart new science known as ethology. Let's get my transparencies out, because I think these will help if they don't all fall off the end. Put this thing on. Now, ethology, can you see all that? Oh, that's right, yeah. Ethology has had an impact on a large number of different areas, but it's been particularly felt in the area of developmental psychology, where John Bowlby has very successfully applied the ethological approach to advancing our understanding about bonding between mothers and children. The ethologists have also administered something of a shake-up to sociology, that discipline which has been rather unkindly defined as the study of people who don't need to be studied by people who do. The result of this has been the startling new science of sociobiology, largely under the influence of E.O. Wilson. Ethology has also made a very exciting contribution to the anthropological study of adolescence, and also to the social and political implications of bonding between males, and this work has been very largely done by Robin Fox. Yet Jungians have remained aloof from all these developments, and I think this is a great pity, and indeed it's more than a pity, it's a great irony, because the hypotheses advanced by Jung more than half a century ago on the basis of his researches into mythology and dreams and active imagination and so on, anticipated all these developments with uncanny accuracy. And how Jung would have loved this irony. Because, you see, it was the practitioners of these very sciences, psychology, sociology, anthropology, and biology, who persistently misunderstood his work, stigmatized him as a crank, and dismissed his concepts of the archetype and the collective unconscious with frank derision. Yet the data which these scientists are so assiduously collecting are not only compatible with Jung's theories, they go a very long way to proving them. They strengthen them, they amplify them, and to an extent that few Jungians, and for that matter few ethologists, appear to imagine or to understand. I think it's very interesting that the man who's done most to advance ethology in the 20th century, Konrad Lorenz, should have a great deal in common with Carl Jung. I mean, they even look alike. They both come, of course, from Central Europe. They're both reared in the same tradition of Germanic scholarship, with particular reverence for Kant and Goethe. Both charismatic personalities capable of inspiring great loyalty amongst their followers, and both endowed with a very strong penchant for swimming against the academic tides of their time in pursuit of their own private visions. But one very important difference between them is the introversion of Jung and the extroversion of Lorenz. And not unsurprisingly, this very important distinction between them has imposed itself on the whole disciplines which they have created. So that where Lorenz is exclusively concerned with the outer forms of behavior, Jung dealt primarily with subjective psychic states and experiences. But in fact, they are both studying the same phenomena and using very much the same sort of concepts. And the complementariness of their two positions, I think, makes a synthesis between them both exciting and timely. Historically, I think we have reached a most important and most interesting stage. I believe that we are on the threshold of establishing a unified science of humanity. And it's my conviction that analytical psychology has as crucial a role to play as ethology in bringing about this new synthesis. Because in his archetypal hypothesis, Jung has bequeathed us a great articulating principle that can bring the whole synthesis of the human sciences together without destroying in the process the numinosity and the wonder of living. Now, this move towards unification is particularly interesting, occurring as it does in an area which, throughout the late 19th century and the whole of this century, has been torn with schism. Really, since psychology parted company with its parent philosophy. You see, psychology split up into experimental, social, clinical, educational, developmental psychology. Psychoanalysis broke up into analytical psychology, Kleinian psychology, Adlerian psychology, and all the other schools, old Uncle Tom Cobley and all. Anthropology broke up into physical, social, and philosophical anthropology. The natural sciences were always already split up into physics, and then later on nuclear physics, physical chemistry, organic chemistry, and then biology, which has gone on to ethology. Then sociology, which broke off into political science, sociobabble, waffle, and gobbledygook, as well as giving rise to the new branch of sociobiology. Now, each of these people, during the late 19th century, most of the 20th century, went their separate ways and staked out territories, which they then proceeded to defend with a tenacity and a bitterness which would shame a tankful of Burmese fighting fish. And this unwitting demonstration of what Robert Ardrey calls the amity-enmity complex, that human social propensity for finding enemies to hate and friends to fight them with, would have been ironic and indeed funny if it hadn't been for the grave consequences that it's had for the advancement of psychology and sociology and anthropology as sciences. The point is that all these sciences have lacked the biological dimension. You see, psychology and psychiatry during this century, most of it, and I'm sure many of us here have been brought up in this tradition, have sought to explain everything in terms of the individual's personal history, without any reference to the history or nature of our species. In the same way, anthropology has been obsessed with the details of how one culture differs from another, seeing each culture as a law unto itself and entirely determined by variations in local climate, geology, child-rearing practices, and so on. And until very recently, anthropologists seem to have forgotten Adolphe Bastiat's teaching that although local customs may differ, all human cultures have more in common than the differences between them. Apart from Jung, hardly anyone in the 20th century has concerned himself with those things which all men and all women in all cultures have in common, or has asked to what extent these universal features might be susceptible to a purely biological explanation. Everyone else has overlooked the simple fact that the forms that human cultures adopt are themselves archetypally determined. As any Martian anthropologist studying us from his spaceship could tell you, all cultures, whatever their geographical location or historical time, display a large number of social traits which are themselves diagnostic of a specifically human culture. Knowledge is, after all, a matter of imposing order on chaos. And all scientific advances come from seeing relationships between things on what has come to be called the comparative method. Take, for example, Darwin. He compared the bones of different species of animals and saw similarities between them, what he called homologs. Here we are. If you look at the top one, we'll look at the bottom one later. The similarities between the forelimbs of the whale, the bat, and the human being. Outwardly, they couldn't seem to be more unlike one another. But when you get down to basics, you see that they have a lot in common. The humerus, the radius, the ulna. Humerus, radius, ulna. Humerus, radius, ulna. These are homologs in anatomy. Now, the great contribution of the ethologists under the guidance of people like Conrad Lorenz and Nico Tinbergen is that they have succeeded brilliantly in applying the comparative method to behavior. They have demonstrated that all species have behavioral characteristics which, if we have eyes to see them, are as distinctive as their physical characteristics. In other words, the ethologists have found homologues in behavior, and I take these as being examples of archetypal functioning at the behavioral level, because Jung, remember, always said and insisted that archetypes not only express themselves psychically in symbols, but also physically in behavior. Well, let's take some examples of homologues in behavior. The ethological attitude to kissing. Kissing, the ethologists argue, is a form of ritualized feeding behavior which has its origins in infancy. The infant, you see, is archetypally programmed to suckle from birth. Here on the right, you see the searching automatism displayed by all newborn infants. All newborn mammals, for that matter, not just human infants, not just primate infants, but mammalian infants. The infant rocks its head from side to side, rhythmically searching with its lips for the nipple. Now, here on the left, you see a Waika Indian woman greeting a European woman by rubbing her mouth with the same rhythmic motion from side to side on her cheek. Now, homologous behavior to this occurs in birds and in chimpanzees. At the top, you see on the left a common tern feeding its chick. On the right, at the same level, you see two adult terns courting. The female, you see, opens her mouth in a ritualized begging posture, and the male tempts her with a delicate morsel. Immediately below them, on the left, you see a raven feeding its chick, and on the right, a pair of adult ravens courting. You can see the similar sort of courtship behavior occurring in black-headed gulls here and in woodpecker finches here. Then at the bottom, on the left, a mother chimpanzee feeds her baby from mouth to mouth, and on the right, two adult chimpanzees greet each other by kissing. Did you know that chimpanzees kissed one another? Well, they do, and we know that thanks to Jane Goodall's marvelous work where she lived in the wild with chimpanzees and photographed them. They also greet each other by the hand, and I'll show you pictures of that in a minute. Now let's go on with this homologous behavior with mouth feeding and kissing. Here on the left, you see a Papuan mother feeding her baby by mouth, and then on the right, two Papuan siblings kissing one another. And below that, you see Nikita Khrushchev greeting his American host with a kiss. I don't know. Can you see who it is? Have you any idea? I keep on trying to find out who the American... Is it Nixon? Is it Nixon? Yes. History doesn't report whether or not either gentleman enjoyed the experience, but there it is. Below the Papuan mother here, you see Ituri pygmies. And here's the main hunter. He's just killed an elephant. He's sitting on the elephant. And he's feeding strips of fat to the other hunters who have assisted him to trap the elephant. And then down here on the right, you see a German biscuit advert. Well, let's look at some other homologous behavior. Can you see them all right? Are they clear? Good. When young animals are startled or frightened or in pain, they immediately seek close physical contact with their mothers. Usually they suckle until they're comforted. or just remain in their mother's arms with the teat in their mouth. And here you see a rhesus infant doing that in her mother's arms, and also a human infant doing the same thing. And then below there's a rather moving picture, because this sort of behavior gets carried over into adult life. There is a soldier comforting another who has lost his buddy in the Korean War. Here are two frightened children, they're Sonjo children, comforting one another. And below that, a rhesus mother comforting her offspring. Then bottom left, a four-year-old female chimpanzee shelters under the hand of her boyfriend. And on the right, you see a German couple doing much the same thing. It's nothing anti-German about this. It's just that these pictures are due to the wonderful work of a German human ethologist called Dr. Eibel Eibersfeld. And he has a wonderful camera. He goes about the world photographing people, and it's a very sneaky arrangement. It shoots sideways. It's got a prism on the front. It's a Leica, needless to say. Anyway, he's got this prism on the front, you see, so that if I wanted to photograph these people together, I pretend to take a photograph of these, and I get a shot of them. So you get these wonderful natural pictures. And obviously, a lot of his photography has gone on in Germany. Now, let's take another homologous behavior, social grooming, which is of terrific importance in all mammalian social species, but particularly in primates. On the left, you'll see a female chimpanzee bowing in greeting to a male, and bowing, incidentally, is regarded by the ethologist as a ritualized invitation to groom. On the right, you'll see Balinese women grooming one another, and immediately below them, rhesus monkeys absorbed in grooming. Grooming is obviously a very comforting form of intimacy, and the gestures involved can themselves be ritualized to offer comfort. And here you see a lady doctor who's comforting a poor man who's just lost his wife. And on the left, you see a priest being blessed by his bishop. Greeting with the open hand. I mentioned it in chimpanzees. Here's one of Jane Goodall's pictures. They do actually shake hands and give one another their hands in exactly the same sort of way and in the same circumstances as we do. It's obviously a biologically determined form of behavior. Waving, greeting with the open hand in that way, I've no weapons, is also a universal behavior that you find in all human communities all the world over. And here you see a little Neapolitan girl sheltering her brother under her left arm, waving with her right hand. Here's a Champagne Islander, probably a left-handed one, doing the same thing. Now, these are terribly interesting. These down here, again, Eibersfeld's sneaky camera. Until he went around the world using this camera, we didn't know something. Perhaps none. I wonder how many of you know this, that when human beings greet one another, whatever the culture, their eyebrows shoot up. At the moment of greeting, the eyebrows go up. And here you see a Balinese, here a Papuan, and you see they are looking down the side, this left side, you see them at the moment they visually fixate a person, and then here you see them at the moment of greeting. You see the Balinese, his eyebrows shoot up. Here's the Papuan, he looks, then he greets, the eyebrows shoot up. Here's a French woman, she looks, and then, bonjour monsieur. Then here is a Waika Indian, he looks, and then up go the eyebrows in greeting. Now, once you know it, it's very obvious. I mean, look out for it in future, and you'll notice that whenever people greet you, their eyebrows go up. If they don't, it's very sinister. Now, shyness and embarrassment, shame, these are universal human emotions, and everywhere, whatever the culture, people express them in the same way. At the top, there's a little 3-year-old German girl who's embarrassed and shy about something, and she turns away and covers her face. It's something that we have all seen, and we all immediately understand when we see it. And then here's a Samoan young lady who was looking at a photograph of a young man, and somebody rather unkindly said that she seemed to be rather interested in him, and this was the coy result. And below that is a Balinese woman who's been told how pretty she is, and again, she does the same thing. Now, flirting behavior is also a very interesting universal human characteristic. And it seems that it's in all, not only humans, but in primates and indeed most mammals, courting is a mixture of come on and I'm going away. It's a repetition. You give the eye and then you look away. Then you give the eye, you say, yes, I'm interested, and then you look away and pretend you're not. And here are some pictures of this happening. At the top, you see a Samburu girl. First, she looks at a young man who's chatting her up, and she's obviously not displeased with what she sees. And then she lowers her lids and looks away. And then below that, here is a Turkana woman doing exactly the same thing. She looks at him, she smiles, she laughs, and then she looks away. And he has hundreds of photographs showing this in all sorts of different cultural situations. Now, the very impressive homologues that the ethologists have found in patterns of aggression, threat behavior, dominance driving. When threatening, many mammals expose their very dangerous canine teeth here. And primates generally tend to pull down the corners of their mouths to do this. And on the left, you see a threatening mandrill, and you see his great teeth and how impressive they are. Now, our canine teeth are not nearly as big as they were in our ancestors because we don't use them as much and we don't need them as much because we've developed other weapons. But nevertheless, this, in anger, pulling down their mouth towards the side is still a universal pattern. And on the right, you see a kabuki actor portraying the traditional expression of rage in the Japanese theater. And here you see a little Neapolitan girl in a state of anger. You can see she's absolutely livid, and she's pulling her mouth down in that way. Now, when animals threaten one another and are making an effort to impress, they try to make themselves bigger. And they emphasize their height and the breadth of their shoulders. When primates get angry, the hair bristles over their shoulders, making them look bigger. And this characteristic has been retained by hairy humans. Here you see an artist's impression of one of our ancestors doing it. But in fact, quite a number of our contemporaries do the same thing. And if any of you ladies have hairy husbands, next time you get him in the bathroom, try making him mad and observe the bristling response. But most men, in fact, are not hairy over their shoulders, but they compensate for this by emphasizing their shoulders by sartorial means. And here you see a Waiika Indian, a kabuki actor again, emphasizing, and here Tsar Alexander II, no less. Soldiers in most nations, most armies, emphasize their shoulders either with epaulettes or, you know, gold braid, scrambled eggs, and all sorts of things on their shoulders. Now, fighting for dominance in social species It's a universal practice between males in the great majority of social species. And such fights have the characteristics of a tournament, and they don't usually result in injury. Because when a male knows that he's beaten, he makes a gesture of appeasement, and the victor ceases his attack. Here you see at the top two marine iguanas on the Galapagos Islands involved in a tournament. The iguana on the right gets the worst of it, and he ends the contest by lying flat on the ground in an unmistakable posture of submission. The lower illustration shows appeasement postures in the wolf, lying on the back and exposing the soft belly, and also cringing and begging for food. This infantile behavior has a disarming effect on the victor. And it's not only in wolves, of course, it happens in dogs, the domestic dog. You know perfectly well your dog behaves like this when you're angry with him. So, overall, it seems that there is a simple archetypal polarity in dominance and submissive behavior, which is found in all social species. Dominance is expressed by making oneself bigger, taller, broader. I mean, Western movies do the same thing when gunmen approach one another. Whereas submissiveness is expressed by making oneself smaller, shorter, and narrower. And these characteristics, interestingly enough, have been ritualized all the world over in the way that greetings take account of social position. Now, in our egalitarian culture, these have been modified, but they're still there. On the left, you see a female bowing to a dominant male, making herself smaller. He accepts the greeting in the upright position. Dominant social status, you see, is expressed by greeting from the erect position, while subordination is expressed by nodding, bowing, or prostration, making oneself very much smaller. Here you see a German policeman greeting President de Gaulle. Here you see a Laotian greeting a social superior. Here you see ancient Egyptians greeting their ruler. Here you see Ife people greeting their ruler. And here Fula women greeting their supervisor. So all these are examples of homologues in behavior. They are examples of archetypal expression. And they show how striking are the results of using the comparative method. Well, just as Darwin found homologues in anatomy, and the ethologists have demonstrated homologues in patterns of behavior, so Jung traced homologues in symbols and mythologems. He realized that however diverse and richly complicated human symbols might be, they were, in fact, variations on a number of universally recurrent themes. And it was this insight which caused him to formulate the theory of archetypes, which attributed the universal occurrence of homologous symbols and mythologems to the existence of universal structures within the human mind, within all members of the species, Homo sapiens sapiens. Now, Jung summed this up. If I can find it. Yes, here we are. In a passage in his foreword to Esther Harding's book, Women's Mysteries, which I guess is known to quite a lot of you. But it's quite an important passage. I hope you can see it from where you are. It starts here. He says, "The psychology of primitives, folklore, mythology, and the science of comparative religion open our eyes to the wide horizons of the human psyche and give us that indispensable aid we so urgently need for an understanding of unconscious processes. Only when we see in what shape and what guise dream symbols, which seem to us unique, appear on the historical and ethnic scene, can we really understand what they are pointing at? Also, once equipped with this extensive comparative material, we can comprehend more nearly that factor which is so decisive for psychic life, namely the archetype. Then he goes on, I think, in a very important passage. He says, of course, this term, archetype, is not meant to denote an inherited idea. You see, there's nothing Lamarckian about it. It's not meant to denote an inherited idea, but rather an inherited mode of psychic functioning, corresponding to the inborn way in which the chick emerges from the egg, the bird builds its nest, a certain kind of wasp stings the motor ganglion of the caterpillar, and eels find their way to the Bermudas. In other words, he says, using the ethological term, it is a pattern of behavior. He's talking about archetypes. This aspect of the archetype, he concludes, the purely biological one, is the proper concern of scientific psychology. Well, this notion of the archetype has been around for a long time, and no Jungian would be surprised by the fact that the very idea of archetypes being archetypal should crop up in different forms. In recent history, the ethologists, under the guidance of Lorenz, have rediscovered the theory of archetypes, only in their case they call them innate releasing mechanisms. John Bowlby, in his study of infants, has also rediscovered the archetypal theory, but in his case he refers to archetypes as behavioral systems. I've since talked this through with him, and he has acknowledged that indeed he is largely talking about the same things, but until we had these conversations, he said that he hadn't really understood what Jung was on about, but that in fact there is a very close approximation between his concept and the Jungian concept of archetypal systems. Then Robin Fox, the ethological anthropologist, talks about the biogrammar inherent in the human mind, which programs us to behave in cultural ways and produce the sort of cultures that human beings do produce. Then the linguistics expert, Noam Chomsky, I'm sure familiar to many of you, in his study of language, argues that in fact there are deep structures in language and in the brain, that if you analyze all the languages which human beings speak, they have certain basic elements in common, and that the brain has certain deep structures or basic elements underlying the whole linguistic apparatus. And he says that this accounts for the miraculous way in which young children learn coherent language, and also accounts for the mistakes they make as they are learning it, because they conjugate verbs as if they were all regular, because they learn the basic elements of syntax so quickly. And the things they have to learn is how to conjugate the irregular verbs. Then, interestingly, the Gestalt psychologist Wolfgang Köhler in the 20s and 30s talked about isomorphs, the way in which our perception of the outside world is determined by the structure of our perceptual apparatus and the neurons in our brains linked to that apparatus. And he called these isomorphs, and it's very close to the archetypal theory. Then the 19th century ethnologist Adolf Bastian traveled about the world studying all the vast numbers of different cultures that existed at that time. And what impressed him was that although all local differences were great, there were common ideas which cropped up again and again in all the cultures that he studied. And he called these elementary ideas, Elementargedanken. Then the German astronomer Johannes Kepler, the 17th century astronomer, wrote a fascinating paper in which he said that his great excitement in scientific discovery was due to what he called a process of matching. He said that his observations of the universe and of the world, he could comprehend by matching them to ideas which were already implanted in his mind, he believed, by God. And these ideas, these essential ideas which he believed were in his mind, are a sort of early formulation of archetypal theory. And then the biologist Ernst Mayr also talks about open programs which exist in all animal and plant species, which prepare the organism to behave in certain ways in relation to stimuli coming from the environment. So you see, there are many people who are using the archetypal hypothesis in different forms. Really, they're talking about the same thing, but they're using different terms to describe it. Are you all right? Are you with me so far? Good. I'd like to go on to consider with you a very common and very famous ethological example, courting behavior in sticklebacks. I'm still not quite clear whether or not you have sticklebacks in this country. Do you know what sticklebacks are? They're little silver fish, and we have them quite a lot in England in the streams, that's to say, not the unpolluted ones. And I'm sure that they must be here too. Yeah, well, they're very interesting because their courting behavior is really a kind of piscine equivalent of a Rogers and Astaire movie. When a male stickleback encounters a female whose belly is swollen with mature eggs, he courts her by going into a smart zigzag dance routine. Now, the capacity to perform this famous ballet is built into the nervous system of the courting male. You see, he doesn't have to go to an aquatic school of dancing to learn how to perform the necessary movements. All he needs to cue his performance is the appearance of the swollen belly of the female. No behaviorist, not even Dr. Skinner himself, has ever taught him that swollen belly means, may I have the pleasure of this dance. On the contrary, the sexual archetypal system operating in the stickleback incorporates the precise instruction, look out for fellow stickleback with swollen belly, when you see it, dance. Now, once that happens, she accepts him as a partner, and then there's an elaborate chain of behavior which each triggers off in the other, so that once she's responded, he leads her down to the nest that he has already prepared for her. And he shows her the entrance. And then she watches, and then he stands back, and in she goes. And then he prods her with his snout, and that excites her, and she then releases her eggs into the nest. She then leaves and swims away, and he stays there on station, fanning the eggs with his flippers in order to oxygenate them until they're hatched. So you see, there's a very elaborate chain of behavior there. Now, John Bowlby believes, and I believe it with him, that the maternal archetypal system is similarly programmed. That, in other words, a woman doesn't learn to love her newborn baby, but within moments of delivery, provided she's not bombed out of her mind on drugs, she perceives the baby's helplessness and its need for her, and she is moved by irresistible feelings of love, the strength of which may come as quite a surprise to her. Bowlby conceives the growth of attachment as depending on a series of what he calls goal-directed behavioral systems. And he argues that these operate, for want of a better analogy, cybernetically, that's to say, like electronic systems through positive and negative feedback, both in the mother and in the child. So, innate response patterns in the child, such as staring, smiling, crying, babbling, laughing, you are, as an example, release parental feelings. You see, he's taken onto the lap. in the mother, together with maternal behavior, which is both appropriate, which we are now, I won't call attention to it, but it says it's so appropriate, and adjusted to the baby's needs. It's lovely to see. The universal occurrence of such responses left Bowlby in absolutely no doubt that they are innate and that they have evolved as a result of their survival value for the species. Now, further evidence that they are indeed innate comes from the work of René Spitz, which must be very familiar to all of you. His work with masks on two-month-old babies. He found that if you study the configuration which releases staring behavior and smiling behavior in a baby, all you need is a sort of oval shape with two holes for eyes and a slit for a mouth, preferably turning up at the corners. And just to make it a little bit more salient, you add two eyebrows. And that usually releases smiling if you present this to a two-month-old child. If that doesn't work, what you have to do is move it up and down as if it were nodding. And if that doesn't work, all you need is the human voice, but preferably the high-pitched human voice, because that's more salient, and that releases the staring and the smiling response. Further evidence that this is innate comes from the study of children born blind and deaf. Here you see a girl of nine resting. Here you see her smiling. This is a girl born blind and deaf. There she's smiling. Here she is crying. There's no way in which she can learn those behaviors. They're clearly innate. Below you see the infant schema, which again you're very familiar with. It's exploited by commercial artists and the makers of dolls to release parental behavior in us. Walt Disney was terribly aware of all this. You know, the bulging forehead, the big cheeks, the big eyes, the big head in relation to the small body, and so on. It's very well known to all of us. It releases parental behavior in everybody. Well, let's take another famous and I think very interesting ethological example. Now, that, believe it or not, is a hawk or a goose, depending on which way you see it flying. Now, you can make a wooden model of that, and this is a drawing based on the wooden model which is used in this experiment. And if you hatch out a clutch of chicks, and after they're about 3 or 4 days old, you pull this wooden model in this direction, the direction that makes it look like a hawk, a predatory bird with a short neck. Birds with long necks are not predatory, they eat grass. If you pull this over, the little chicks crouch down and emit a cheeping sound, cheep, 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 which is a warning sound to the others to crouch down. It's an innate defensive response, a very ancient one. Now, the interesting thing about this is that you can breed generations of chicks without releasing this response in them. You don't expose them either to the model of the hawk coming across or to hawks in reality. So they go through generations of not expressing this behavior. Then you can take members of the 10th, 11th, 12th generation. You expose the hawk, and they crouch down, and they cheep. Now, a terrifically interesting example of that occurred in, a most impressive and famous example of this occurred in 1939, when the British ornithologist David Lack proved quite unconsciously and unwittingly that once an archetypal system like this has bred into a species, it breeds true and it never disappears, as long as the species remains the same species. Now, he was studying Darwin's finches on the Galapagos Islands, and then in 1939 he had to go back to Europe to participate in one of the wars that we have there from time to time. What normally happens is that we go on for a few years and get into an unholy mess, and then we ask you if you'd like to join in, and you say, oh, all right, and you come and sort the whole thing out for us, which I think is a marvelous system. And what is more, you also pay to clear up the mess afterwards. I mean, You are really remarkable people, and I say that from the bottom of my heart. But to return to Darwin's finches. On the Galapagos, there are 14 different kinds of finches, and these have evolved from the parent species, which long since disappeared. Hundreds of thousands of years, the parent species on the mainland at Ecuador disappeared. But the 14 different ones that have evolved have elaborated themselves into these wonderfully specific kinds of finch, beautifully adapted to the ecological niche that they find themselves in the Galapagos. And the reason why they have done so well there, whereas the parent finches have disappeared, is because on the Galapagos there are no large birds of prey. There are no creatures like this. So it was quite clear that for nearly a million years, these finches had not crouched down and had cause to cheep. So David Lack didn't want to take these birds that he trapped back with him to England, so he sent them to a great friend of his, an American ornithologist in California, and asked him if he'd like to have them. He said, yes, send them over. He built an aviary for them, and he received these different Darwin finches into his aviary, and he was amazed. Within about 10 minutes, having released them in the aviary, one of the Californian birds of prey, a red-tailed hawk, flew overhead, and to Orr's amazement, they all crouched down on the ground and began to cheep. So you see, for a million years, this archetypal system had remained dormant in the collective unconscious of this species, and there it was suddenly released. I wonder how many such dormant archetypes there may be in us. However, many people would have no difficulty in recognizing that such behavior is instinctive, and most people would say that it's perfectly acceptable to say that such behavior can occur in birds and in mammals. But many would object violently to the suggestion that such behavior could occur in human beings. And they would argue that human behavior is so variable from person to person and from culture to culture that it could never be described as instinctive in any respect. And I know that I was brought up to believe that, and I suspect that quite a lot of you here were brought up to believe that too. But in fact, this extreme position is no longer scientifically tenable. And John Bowlby has done a great deal to erode it. One passage comes from his book, Attachment. And he says, man's behavior is very variable, it's true, but not infinitely so. And though cultural differences are great, certain commonalities can be discerned. Note that term, certain commonalities can be discerned. For example, despite obvious variability, the patterns of behavior, often very intensely motivated, that result in mating, in the care of babies and young children, and in the attachment of young to parents, are found in almost all members of the human race and seem best considered as expressions of, watch this phrase, some common plan. And since they are of obvious survival value, as instances of instinctive behavior. Now, if for some common plan we substitute archetype, this passage is completely in accord with the Jungian position. So, my argument, which I advance with much more backing in my book, is that Jung's position and Jung's evidence, based on mythology and dreams and the study of psychotic fantasies, so on, is corroborated by ethology and comparative anthropology. And it all leads the unbiased mind to the conclusion that Jung was right when he said that the collective unconscious, I'm quoting him, the collective unconscious contains the whole spiritual heritage of mankind's evolution. born anew in the brain structure of every individual. Well, the biologists are convinced that our evolution, our genetic evolution as a species, halted, as far as we can tell, 50,000 years ago. It's one of the great mysteries which biology has not really been able to solve. And that is why it is that all species seem to evolve so far and then stop and then remain the same species and don't evolve any further. So that we have coelacanths that have been around for hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years and bacteria that have been with us for millions of years and so on. And so it seems that we have, in the last 50,000 years, remained essentially the same animal. What development we have achieved since then has not been due to genetic evolution, but to cultural evolution. Our ability to transmit information from one generation to another by non-genetic means. In other words, by word of mouth, and latterly by writing and electronics. In recent centuries, this cultural progress has accelerated to such a pitch that we have moved further from our archetypal roots than any other civilization since agriculture began 10 to 15,000 years ago. This has led to what Jung described as loss of soul. In other words, our technological advance has outstripped the advance of our wisdom. Now, many people besides Jung have stressed the same fact. Fridtjof Capra, for example, writes this beautiful phrase. He says, "The spirituality and moral standards of Lao Tzu and Buddha were clearly not inferior to our own." And Martin Luther King said, "Our scientific power has outrun our spiritual power. We have guided missiles and misguided men." The soldiers, too, have commented on the same thing. General Omar Bradley said, "We have grasped the mystery of the atom and rejected the Sermon on the Mount." And the great historian Arnold Toynbee says, "The human race's prospect of survival were considerably better when we were defenseless against the tigers than they are today when we've become defenseless against ourselves." But the fact remains that what molds your thoughts and mine at this very moment also molded the thoughts of our early ancestors. There's no structural or functional difference between our brains and Newton's, or Plato's, or Tutankhamun's, or the men who painted those little horses in the caves at Lascaux. The 17th century French essayist Montaigne knew this when he said, "Chaque homme porte en lui la forme entière de l'humaine condition." Each man carries in himself the entire form of the human condition. So perhaps we can agree that the major transitions of human life are, as the biologists would say, planned for in the genome, the genetic structure of our species. They are, if you like, archetypally programmed into the self. But what has to concern us as psychologists is the manner to which the activation of this program is dependent on stimuli coming from the environment. Because clearly it must be so dependent, because it's inconceivable to see that the human cycle could be lived out, the human life cycle could be lived out in a vacuum. Just as an infant requires air to activate his respiratory system, so he needs a mother figure to activate the mother archetypal system. Now, I'm sometimes asked why it is that I'm so concerned to see analytical psychology established as a biological science. One girl, a medical student, even asked me if it was because I wished to make Jungian psychology respectable, whatever she meant by that. I replied that it wasn't really because I wanted to see Jung made respectable, but because I wanted to see biology made humane. Because I didn't want to see it lose touch with ethical values and descend into being an arid form of biotechnology. But afterwards, when I reflected on it, I realized it went much deeper than that, and it tied up very much with my own personal history and experience. Because in my 20s, I spent 4 of my university years in the study of academic experimental psychology. Because like many idealistic young people, I believed that the proper study of mankind was man, and I believed that psychology must hold some of the keys. But like most of them, I suspect I fear, disappointed. Psychology, we discovered, possessed few keys, and the doors which they opened led into dismal chambers. Despite more than 70 years of effort, psychology had still fallen short of its ambition of becoming an established and respectable science. And I think this was largely because it based itself on the wrong model, seeing itself more as a form of physics rather than as an offshoot of biology. Consequently, decades of experience had yielded a whole mass of disparate findings and data, but absolutely no thread to tie them all together. So, possessing no basis in biology, psychology could only lend itself the semblance of coherence and of being a scientific discipline by a trick, I fear. This is my argument, and I stand by it. It turned itself into a kind of theology, a theology of established dogmas, which it became heresy for the faithful to deny. A major article of faith was, thou shalt study organisms as blank slates. In other words, this dogma asserted that organisms must be approached as essentially unstructured and unprogrammed, owing little to heredity and practically everything to the environment, and that no determining principles existed in life apart from a handful of drives like hunger, sex, the desire to avoid pain, so on. Thorndike's law of effect. Well, having been brought up as a free spirit, I must confess I found all this very wearying. We were forbidden to use taboo four-letter words like mind, and taught never to attribute purpose to behavior. Instead, like fundamentalist theologians, we had to repeat ritually prescribed texts. These said that responses were emitted. I remember my tutor at Oxford used to talk about responses being emitted, purely as a means of gaining gastronomic and sexual rewards, the heaven of gastronomy and sex, or avoid the hell of painful electric shocks. All that mattered was behavior that could be quantified and elevated on the high altar of statistical analysis. The laws of learning, you see, were the Nicene Creed at that time of academic psychology. The very idea that anything so structured as human nature or animal nature could exist was complete anathema and cause for excommunication. So, not surprisingly, the academic psychologists were not exactly enthusiastic in their reception of ethological theories, particularly when these were applied to human subjects. Most of them, indeed, were bitterly critical of Bowlby's application of ethological concepts to the study of human attachment bonds, maintaining doggedly that the differences between animals and men were so fundamental as to invalidate any inferences which could be drawn from the behavior of one and applied to the psychology of the other. But in this, they were, of course, guilty of a monumental piece of hypocrisy, because they themselves have been doing precisely the same thing for years in the case of the poor old wretched Norway rat. Because it was from the sufferings of this sorely tried creature that the experimental psychologists had derived their precious laws of learning, and which they then proceeded to apply with well-subsidized enthusiasm to the pupils and students of our schools and universities. They blandly overlooked the fact that if Bowlby's inferences were invalid, then so indeed were theirs. Moreover, Bowlby's observations were drawn from a large variety of species, including our closest relatives, the primates, living in their natural habitats, whereas the psychologist's observations were drawn from but one species, the poor old Norway rat, emitting its responses in highly artificial circumstances, namely mazes and psychological laboratories in universities. Rats, as you know, are nocturnal creatures, whereas experimental psychologists are not. not by the time they've reached senior lecturer status, at any rate. And somebody had to be kept out of bed during working hours, and the experimental psychologists didn't see why it should be them. So, yawning wearily, the rats got on with staggering round yet another maze. Sometimes they had their limbs cut off to see if they could get round by rolling. So sure were the behaviourists that rats had no minds that they thought they must keep their memories in their legs. Rats are, in fact, of course, intelligent creatures, and they must have wondered about the insomniac sadists who murdered their sleep. I certainly did. But there was no stopping them. For decades, the experimental psychologists, bless them, repeated and repeated their boring conjuring trick of pulling habits out of rats. While, meantime, the rest of... Bless you for that, it gave me a chance to have a drink. The rest of mankind proceeded with its usual business of mutual extermination, environmental pollution, exhausting the world's resources, and developing ever more destructive instruments of war. And the great psychological issues of man's nature and destiny went completely unconsidered in the psychology laboratories and departments of the world. And it was only the analysts who still dealt with them. But, of course, the experimental psychologists dismissed them as being hopelessly unscientific. Well, this put people like me, who wanted to be both a psychologist and a psychiatrist, in a difficult position. As my own Jungian analysis progressed, I learned infinitely more about human nature and human psychology than all my years in the psychology laboratories had done. And yet my professors, whom I respected, insisted that analytical psychology was mystical eyewash and had absolutely no contribution to make to 20th century science. But for their part, of course, the analysts were not unperturbed, really, by this withering academic disdain. They hadn't time, you see. They had a job to do. And they realized that if they waited for the academic psychologists to test in their laboratories the hypotheses on which analytic therapies are based, both they and their patients would be dead before the results were ready for publication. But this, alas, did not prevent the analysts from becoming as dogmatic and as schismatic as their psychological and academic detractors. Indeed, the split between Freudian psychoanalysis and Jungian analytical psychology was in fact widened by the prevailing academic climate, because Freudian theories coincided more readily with the environmentalist prejudices of the behaviorists, while Jungian psychology put itself right beyond the pale by asserting that the human psyche had a structure and a mode of functioning that was shared by all members of the species, and that the individual was not a blank slate, but possessed a human nature which, like the human body, was subject to the laws of evolution. But because of the absolute polarity between the two positions, Jung was unable to pull the psychologists out of their intrepid one-sidedness. He seems to have decided quite early on that he could do nothing about it, and he'd better let them get on with it. In the two essays, he wrote, "Whosoever wishes to know about the human mind will learn nothing, or almost nothing, from experimental psychology." Rather rough judgment, but there it is. And when my own analyst, Irene Champernowne, very boldly decided in 1938 to do a doctorate thesis for London University based on some aspect of analytical psychology, she was advised by Jung to say absolutely nothing about archetypes or the collective unconscious, but to base her work on the word association test. You'll be able to get some statistics out of that, he said with a twinkle in his eye. You must give them plenty of statistics. And of course he was right. And in the 50s and 60s, I had to play the same statistical games with my academic examiners when I produced my theses. But I didn't mind that as much as I did the behaviorist fundamentalism and the quasi-theological dogmatism of what I then called the academic psychological church. For me, Jung's ideas succeeded not only because they were concerned with the crucial phenomena of human life and because they gave primacy to psyche, but because he also placed these phenomena firmly within the evolutionary process, while academic psychology failed precisely because it did not. Well, the major contribution of Lorenz and the ethologists lies, I think, in the fact that they have brought about an enantiodromia. They have pulled psychology back from its crazy affair with physics and brought it into the family of biology where it belongs. I mean, the point that I'm really trying to make, this is a crucial one, is that a non-biological psychology is futile. To be of any use, psychology must have its roots firmly established in biology, because we sentient, spiritual, inventive creatures, though we may be, are biological entities. Our very existence is founded in our biology. Without biology, we are nothing. We don't exist. A psychology unrooted in biology, possesses no coherence, no credibility, for it has no Archimedean point, no epistemological foundation at all. Now, the crucial thing about analytical psychology is that Jung rooted it in biology. Because he rooted it in the archetype, and he defined archetypes as biological entities. He saw clearly that archetypes are present in related forms throughout the whole animal kingdom. And like all biological entities, they have a natural history. In other words, they are subject to the laws of evolution. And through them, we are connected to the universe. You see, because the archetype, as Jung conceived it, is the fundamental precondition of life itself. Its manifestations not only reach upwards to the spiritual heights of religion, art, and metaphysics, but also down into the dark realms of organic and inorganic matter. I won't go on much longer because I'm sure I'm tiring you, but the thing I would like to ask and share with you is the question, what has Jung to contribute to the new synthesis in the sciences which I believe is occurring? Has he got anything to contribute? Or is he merely an interesting historical figure whose contributions lie in the past? Well, I don't know what your feelings about this are, but I must confess that mine are that I believe that he has more to contribute now than ever in his lifetime. I believe that people are able to understand him now in a way that they were not able to understand him when he was alive. The fact is that he was so far ahead of his time, and certainly so far ahead of the behavioral scientists in his thinking, that they and many of us are only just beginning to catch up with him. And that's not all. It's commonly said nowadays that collectively we are in danger of making life on our planet literally insupportable by two things. One is pollution, and the other is nuclear catastrophe. Now, the Jungian diagnosis of this state of affairs is quite simple and straightforward. He says that through one-sided extroverted development of the thinking function, what I have called left hemispheric imperialism, we have lost touch with ourselves, i.e. our basic archetypal nature. And this, he argues, is clearly reflected in the behavioral sciences, which were in his lifetime, he believed, and very much more in ours, in danger of becoming mere biotechnologies. It's nothing, say nothing against biotechnology as such, but heaven preserve us from our whole humanities falling into mere biotechnology. Because the danger is that if we do, we shall be led into a state in which we treat ourselves as the statistical objects of technology. Now, this tendency is already about us. Take, for example, Richard Dawkins' very influential book that I'm sure quite a number of you have seen or read, The Selfish Gene. In that, on the first page, he states his argument. He says, "We are survival machines. We are robot vehicles blindly programmed to preserve the selfish molecules known as genes." There's a danger that this can become accepted biological theory. So as we move inexorably towards the close of the 20th century, the crucial contribution which we as analytical psychologists have to give our culture, I believe, is nothing more nor less than the Jungian attitude. And I believe that this attitude can correct so much that is potentially destructive about the behavioral sciences. This isn't to deny them or reject them or say, get thee behind me to them as a whole. I'm just stressing the danger that they could fall into. Well, what is wrong with them? I think, in the first place, one of the great dangers is that they are very prone to confuse behavior with mind. In other words, they do, in Jungian terms, denigrate psyche. Secondly, they are essentially statistical. In other words, they inexorably devalue the individual. Thirdly, they are narrow and self-serving, and they are reductive. They look to the past, they look to where we came from, and they don't make use of prospective concepts, of teleological concepts, of where we are going and the influence of the future. Fifthly, they ignore the archetypal, phylogenetic, biological, evolutionary dimension. In other words, they tend to ignore the whole corpus of Darwinian theory. Many of them are changing, but up until very recently that has been true. Now, I believe that the Jungian attitude can compensate for all this. We Jungians are often castigated for our alleged conservatism, but the fact of the matter is that the idea of the collective unconscious is perhaps one of the most subversive ideas to have surfaced in the 20th century. Because, not to put too fine a point on it, it's anti-classical, it's anti-enlightenment, it's anti-imperialist, it's anti-Marxist, and it's anti-European. You see, the European ideal of the educated gentleman, self-aware, confronting destiny through the employment of his own free will and his skeptical intelligence, studying the laws of nature with scientific rigor and bending them to his will, has led us into a collective delusion, Maya. And it's largely encouraged by no less a person than René Descartes himself. And this collective delusion is that we can create our lives and shape our world in whatever form we think fit. The self knows that this is nonsense, and that ultimately such madness is doomed. To misquote René Descartes himself, cogito ergo boom. Now, ethologists, like other behavioral scientists, are of course concerned, as I said right at the beginning, with the outer manifestations of living organisms rather than their subjective experiences. And as a result, a huge theoretical gap exists between the outer world of behavior and the inner world of experience. And yet it's this inner world of experience which is the prima materia of our awareness of life. And it's surely absurd that a discipline that calls itself a psychological science should proceed as if such phenomena were unimportant or didn't exist. And it's this very absurdity that I believe that analytical psychology, if its basic postulates are verified by scientific method, that it's this very absurdity that analytical psychology can rectify. Because Jung, it seems to me, still holds the gap between inner events and outer events. Archetypes, he wrote, are systems of readiness for action and at the same time images and emotions. The influence of René Descartes was to result in the divorce between body and mind and behavior and psyche. And his influence continues to force them apart. But Jung, on the other hand, saw the archetype as the common origin of both behavioral and psychic events. And this, it seems to me, is a contribution of the highest contemporary significance because it enables us to escape the pitfalls of epiphenomenalism and Cartesian dualism, which have impeded psychology from the very beginning. Now, if we establish analytical psychology as a biological science and accept our psychic continuity with all other animal species, does this mean that there is no distinction to be made between human and other categories of life? Well, to me, it appears certain that the human species has arrived at its present level of development by the same processes of biological selection that have determined the qualities of all the other species in the animal kingdom. Of that I'm in no doubt. But I believe that the human species is different from all others in one important respect. Man and woman alone possess the capacity for self-transformation, the ability to redirect their lives through the application of conscious awareness. Other animal species are able to fulfill themselves only, you see, within the narrow limits of their instinctual patterns of behavior. They can become no more than what they were made to be. In other words, they can maturate, but they can't individuate. We, however, can transcend the purely instinctive goals programmed by our genetic structure. We can create philosophies, religions, and political systems, and we can work towards goals that we think we want. Now, it was on account of this capacity that Jung warned modern man to beware of getting out of touch with his basic nature through hyperdevelopment of ego consciousness. But provided we do remain in touch with our basic nature, our capacity for consciousness enables us to transform the archetypal pattern into behavior and into patterns of behavior and patterns of experience which can be shared. And it's in this process of transformation that the human spirit finds its highest achievement and analytical psychology its profoundest practical purpose. When it comes to ethics and science, I believe that quite obviously we have passed the time when it was possible to proclaim the ethical neutrality of science. For the new scientific psychologist, ethical attitudes must inform his every endeavor. To quote Lorenz again, the only things that still tend to keep humanity on the right path, he said, are the emotional feelings for values, something that is rapidly getting lost in technology. Now, in this view, Lorenz is, as in so many other respects, at one with Jung. One of Jung's great strengths was the respect he always showed for what he called the feeling value inherent in the data of psychology, arguing that once we lost sight of those values, psychology would inevitably become a branch of mechanical engineering. Psychology, he wrote in Man and Its Symbols, is the only science that has to take the factor of value, i.e. feeling, into account, because this is the link between physical events and life. Psychology, he said, is often accused of not being scientific on this account, but its critics fail to understand the scientific and practical necessity of giving due consideration to feeling. So, as the behavioral sciences begin to reach out towards one another in an effort to create a new synthesis, Jung's voice needs to be heard. His life's work is a testimony to the clear vision with which he viewed our plight. He never tired of repeating that however much we may come to know about the archetypes, we must never forget that their actual value, their meaning, can only be perceived when they are constellated in the consciousness of the human individual. He saw the human personality as a kind of, as what one might call the aperture of time, the eye of the needle through which all creation must pass in its movement forwards. For outside the consciousness of the human individual, there can be no meaning, because unlike the tree in Bishop Berkeley's courtyard, meaning can only exist when there is a conscious human being to perceive it. When the last human being dies, meaning will disappear from the solar system. In this sense, the individual human being is quite literally the measure of all things. His value is above politics and above science, and if we lose sight of the individual, we lose everything. In a wonderful passage, Jung wrote, "The great events of world history are at bottom profoundly unimportant. In the last analysis, the essential thing is the life of the individual. This alone makes history. Here alone do the great transformations take place. And the whole future, the whole history of the world, ultimately springs as a gigantic summation from these hidden sources in individuals." Well, in contrast to the traditional academic psychology and biotechnology, how well this harmonizes with the vital legacy of the humanist tradition, a concern for the quality of human life. One thinks of Rousseau, who said, "The man who has lived the most is not he who has counted the most years, but he who has most felt life." So to end, if we are to avert the horrors of Brave New World and Orwell's 1984, I believe we must espouse a psychology and a society which will accept and serve the inalienable right of individuals to follow the path of their own individuation. In reality, wrote Jung, individuation is an expression of that biological process by which every living thing becomes what it was destined to become from the beginning. Clearly, we have to respect the nature of the animal that we are, what Jung termed the self, if we are to pursue the right therapeutic, political, and social courses. And that respect can only be derived from knowledge, because we can't respect what we don't know. And such knowledge and respect for the self is the very essence of the Jungian quest. And it's this which must be allowed to inform our research as scientists, as well as our labours as physicians. Thank you very much for being such a marvellously attentive audience. It's all right. I'd be very happy to discuss anything you want to discuss. Yeah.
illustration of the home law is excellent. I'd like to see more, perhaps, in the way of religious activities, the easement of a big animal, a big animal, more than the idea of a superior ruling father, figure, spirit. I recall, how much you credence do you give to evaluations of Desmond Morris at the human zoo, drawing comparison of the red-headed skin of soldiers who got out of prison and are used for discipline and submission posture, such as one illustration of the women presented the backside to the zoo in mind?
Well, lots of primates do that. I mean, chimpanzees do that. It's one of the ways in which they express their acceptance of their social position vis-a-vis a dominant animal. I mean, these are just patterns of behavior, and they are just illustrative of the way in which archetypal determinants can influence behavior as well as psychological experience. Because when I think most people accept the idea that when you come across a universal pattern or a universal symbol or a universal happening which seems to occur in all human communities, you're dealing with an archetype. And so when one comes across these universal patterns of behavior, they're very intriguing. I think it's very important one doesn't exaggerate the importance of things like this, but we all recognize that these are part of the human condition, and we have to take these into account. It doesn't mean to say that we have to be in the grip of those archetypes and we have to identify with them, because as we all know, it can be quite destructive to be identified with an archetype or be in its grip. We have to take an ethical, conscious attitude to it. Now, you asked about religion. Well, yes, of course, I accept that religious belief is archetypally determined, that we are religious animals, that it's a very aberrant culture that doesn't have an intact religion and a belief in its gods. And we are in a state of being aberrant because we are losing faith in our gods and in our God and losing faith in our religious values. And that's most unusual because the great majority of cultures known have these. What?
We're individuating, but we're maturing and
what you would accept the honest to God position that God is teaching us to live without him. Well, I think that's what most of us are having to do. That's certainly it, whether we want to or not. That's right. Yes, anybody else? Sorry about this, I get very thirsty on these occasions. I won't drink too much because I don't want to have to go up on the second floor before we finish.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.